From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the new president of the AFL-CIO, John Sweeney, he's credited with revitalizing the labor movement and taking it in a more militant direction. Also, growing up white at the end of white rule in Rhodesia, which has since become Zimbabwe, we talk with journalist Peter Godwin. He was conscripted into the military during the civil war that marked the end of white rule. He's written a new memoir. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the expanded video version of the Beatles anthology. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Carl Castle. A U.S. fighter jet has fired on an Iraqi radar site after the Iraqi radar began tracking the Air Force F-16. The aircraft was monitoring the expanded no-fly zone in southern Iraq that went into effect earlier today. NPR's Martha Raddatz has the story.
The radar had apparently painted or targeted the F-16 and was about to fire a surface-to-air missile at the U.S. jet. Instead, the F-16 launched a HARM missile at the radar site, rendering it non-operational. This attack follows 2 days of cruise missile attacks on southern Iraq. 44 missiles have now been fired at air defense sites in the no-fly zone. This attempt by Saddam Hussein's forces to strike a U.S. aircraft demonstrates two things. First, all of the air defense capabilities in the no-fly zone have not been destroyed, despite the barrage of cruise missile attacks. And second, Saddam Hussein is defying the United States' efforts to enforce the zone. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
At the United Nations, the Security Council is scheduled to consult behind closed doors regarding the situation in Iraq. From New York, Linda Fasulo reports.
On Tuesday, British diplomats introduced a draft resolution that condemns Iraq's military attacks on the Kurdish city of Erbil and calls for a withdrawal to previous positions. But it makes no reference to the American cruise missile response. And that was criticized by Russia's ambassador, Sergei Lavrov, who called Washington's initial attack disproportionate and unacceptable. He said all sides should refrain from using force. Meanwhile, two other permanent members with veto power, France and China, reacted cautiously to the proposed measure, which also calls on Iran to end any military involvement in northern Iraq. It is not yet clear how council members will respond in light of a second U.S. attack last night. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo in New York.
The National Hurricane Center has extended a hurricane watch farther up the Atlantic coast to Oregon Inlet, North Carolina. It runs down to Sebastian Inlet, Florida. A hurricane warning is likely to be issued by tonight for that area of the coastline. The hurricane is bypassing the Bahamas and is headed for the Georgia-South Carolina border area. Mike Hopkins is a forecaster with the National Hurricane Center in Miami.
The center of Hurricane Fran is located 485 miles southeast of Charleston, South Carolina, and the maximum sustained winds are now 115 miles an hour, and we could see some further strengthening even during the next 24 hours or so.
Meanwhile, South Carolina Governor David Beasley has declared a state of emergency. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 2.22 to 5646.54, trading is light, and the Nasdaq Composite Index is unchanged at 1142.29. This is NPR News. The FBI said today it plans to shift 500 agents to investigate domestic and international terrorism after finding itself stretched thin by a number of high-profile cases. The agency says the counterterrorism unit continues to investigate the June truck bombing that killed 19 U.S. airmen in Saudi Arabia, the July 17th crash of TWA Flight 800 that killed 230 people, and the July 27th bombing at the Olympics in Atlanta that killed two people and injured 111. Officials say agents will be reassigned from other unspecified duties to fighting terrorism. Congressional leaders may be about to give up on one of their key economic proposals, a package of tax cuts. The Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott says he doesn't see how a tax cut bill could pass before adjournment. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Republicans made lowering taxes a cornerstone of their economic policy. Earlier this year, they outlined a major tax reduction bill in a three-part budget package. But with less than a month to go before adjournment, Majority Leader Lott says, in his opinion, it's not going to happen.
I would like to see a tax cut proposal, but I'm a realist. I think maybe y'all have already figured that out about me. And the reality is I don't think we can get it done in September.
Lott says presidential politics will get in the way, and he's afraid a tax cut bill would be a tempting target for all kinds of riders that the Senate wouldn't be able to deal with. Lott's position is certain to disappoint tax cut supporters who are eager to pass something before the elections. I'm Peter Kenyon at the Capitol.
Spending on new construction fell sharply during July to its lowest point in 5 months. The Commerce Department said construction was down 1.4%. The falloff was much more than anticipated by the experts on Wall Street, who had forecast only a 0.2% decrease. Declines were across the board, affecting both privately and publicly financed projects. I'm Carol Castle, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, John Sweeney, has been credited with revitalizing the labor movement. Last October, he was voted president of the AFL-CIO. He was the opposition candidate, promising to make the union movement more aggressive. His opponent, Thomas Donohue, had become interim president just a few months before the election, after longtime President Lane Kirkland retired rather than face strong opposition. John Sweeney is the former president of the Service Employees International Union. During his tenure, the union nearly doubled in size at a time when membership in the AFL-CIO was declining. Sweeney has a new book called America Needs a Raise. He spoke at the Democratic Convention and campaigned with President Clinton on Labor Day. I asked Sweeney how comfortable labor is with Clinton.
Well, I think that we're very comfortable with President Clinton. We did not take the endorsement process lightly. We did it after reaching out to our members in polls and surveys, and not just within the AFL-CIO, but within individual unions. And we were confident that our members supported an endorsement for the president. But we also recognized that we had differences with the president. At the time we endorsed, probably the most important difference was over NAFTA. Since then, we've had our differences over welfare reform. But basically, the president is viewed by our members as a pro-worker president, as one who has tried to address those issues, but unfortunately has run into some problems with the Congress in terms of those issues. And I think that the president is committed to addressing the issues of America's working families, and that he's comfortable with the labor movement. I saw him on Labor Day when he appeared at two large workers' rallies in two different cities, in Green Bay and Milwaukee, and the welcome that he received from families in those areas was just so impressive.
The more conservative wing of the Democratic Party is trying to head in the opposite direction than you want the party to head in. What are you trying to do to influence the party from inside?
Well, if you just look at the number of delegates to the Democratic National Convention who were union members, and I'm including all the AFL-CIO unions as well as the National Education Association, there were approximately 1,200 to 1,300 delegates who were union members. This is about a fourth of all the delegates. That shows an interest at the grassroots level in politics. What we're doing in terms of our politics is participating in the process more aggressively and independently. But we're using television and radio to raise the issues of concerns of working people. We're sending organizers to congressional districts to mobilize grassroots activists and members who are interested in politics. We're asking them to volunteer some time to taking the message, a message of economic justice, to their fellow workers, to their neighbors, to their community leaders, and we're also encouraging them to do letter writing campaigns and to hold meetings. We want these politicians to be responsible, and we want to hold them accountable on issues that affect America's working families.
Your mission is in part to address people within the Democratic Party. In other words, to address Democratic candidates and Democratic congressmen and have them be more sympathetic to your issues?
I wish that there were more Republicans. In the past, we've had greater support from Republicans on these issues, but over the past couple of years, we've seen a complete turnaround. This is a bipartisan effort. I went to the Republican convention. I was not invited into it, but I held a rally of workers in the San Diego area who had asked me to come. We had a number, not too big a number, but we had some delegates who were union members, and we recognized that probably 20 to 25% of our members are registered Republicans. It's not about party politics. It's not about candidates of either party. It's about electing candidates who will support solutions to workers' problems and holding these candidates accountable.
Yeah, in 1994, according to the New York Times, 40% of voters from union households voted Republican in the congressional elections. Some people assume that the labor vote is a Democratic vote. What does the 40% say?
Well, I think we saw in 1994, I don't agree that it was as high as 40%, but it was probably close to it. The 40% poll was done by Newt Gingrich's pollster. But the bottom line is that the working Americans rebelled against the establishment. They were voting their own frustrations with their own lives and their own consideration of where candidates were and what was happening inside the Beltway. But they weren't voting to see Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid under attack or reductions made in their educational programs, environment, safety, and health. I mean, they were voting out of their own frustration. And what they saw happen after that really, I think, turned them around. And I think we're going to see a change in Congress in November.
What are you saying that they saw that turned them around?
They saw the attacks on programs that they felt were necessary to them and to their families, broad programs that crossed the bounds of organized labor and unorganized, middle income, middle management, the Medicare attacks, the opposition to the minimum wage. I mean, Time magazine had a poll where I think close to 80% of the American people supported an increase in minimum wage, not because of the effect on their own lives, but out of a sense of fairness. Bob Dole had an opportunity before he left the Senate to bring the minimum wage up for a vote, and he refused to do it. They talk all the rhetoric, but they're not out there championing the solutions to the problems.
How has the global economy affected unions? In many cases, now an industry has consolidated to a few large multinationals. So instead of thousands or hundreds of small companies, in some industries, you're basically dealing with a couple of really big ones. So how does that change your tactics?
Well, I think you have to look at the broader picture in terms of our economy. I really think that many of the problems that workers have today is basically that corporate America responded to the global economy in the wrong way. They chose not to compete in the old-fashioned way with American know-how and American teamwork. Instead, I'm sorry to say, they chose to compete by driving labor costs, downsizing their workforce, freezing their pay, cutting health care, cutting other benefits as well, raiding their pensions, moving jobs to low-wage labor markets overseas. I believe that they're taking the low road. And in the long run, that leads to a less prosperous, more polarized America and not a more competitive America. I think that we have to have a resuming of corporate responsibility, the social contract that we had in early years in terms of labor and management and government working together. we all recognize that we have to really strive for growth in our economy and face up to all the challenges, but we also have to have respect for workers and respect for human dignity.
John Sweeney is my guest. He's the new head of the AFL-CIO. He was elected last October. Now he has a new book called America Needs a Raise. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with John Sweeney, who was elected the head of the AFL-CIO last October. He has a new book now called America Needs a Raise. John Sweeney, I'd like to talk a little bit about your labor background. I know your father was a bus driver. He was a union man, belonged to the Transport Workers Union. What were your father's thoughts about the union?
My father was a good member of the Transport Workers Union. He had no ambitions for elected office or political office, but he was a member who enjoyed going to union meetings, who was very much interested in their bargaining and in their politics and so on, all the activities of the union. And he represented the best of trade unionism in terms of my own life. And I remember the days of him going out on strike to achieve a 40-hour work week when they were working 48 and 50 hours. I remember how pleased he would be with successful contract negotiations when his vacation was improved and affording him the opportunity to spend much more time with us. It's a very happy memory, and that's the kind of family environment that I grew up in.
What are your memories of the times when your father was on strike and there was no money coming in?
Well, there were tough times, and my mother was a domestic worker, and she would go out doing domestic work to try and make ends meet. But he understood why they had to go on strike, and he understood what was at stake, and they weren't exorbitant demands. They were just demands that were necessary in order to keep up with the standard of living and improve dignity on the job and have a better life for his family.
Now, I'm sure your mother was not unionized. If she were working today, is there a union she could belong to as a domestic worker?
Well, there are different jobs related to domestic work that have been organized. Some of the work that's done in hotels, a lot of the home health care work is similar in some regards, although the level of skill has been increased. When in my earlier days, when I was in New York, I had a goal to try and organize domestic workers, but it was very difficult. And I thought that since we represented the doormen and women in apartment buildings in New York City, that we would be able to impress on our rank and file members the need to organize domestic workers. However, it was very difficult because of the different work situations with domestic workers, but it led us to domestic workers who were moving into home health care at a time when that was expanding back in the late 60s and early 70s. And today we have in New York City alone well over 30,000 home health care workers who go into elderly and disabled people's homes to help them and assist them. And this program has spread across the country.
Tell me a little bit more about why it was so difficult when you started the campaign to organize domestic workers.
Well, they work part-time. They work for many different employers. They do not have to come to any common meeting place or any place where you would have an opportunity to address them on their issues and talk to them about what their problems were related to their jobs. It's, I guess, the inability to communicate and directly with them is probably the biggest obstacle.
What was your first strike?
Actually, my first strike was I was a caddy as a kid.
A golf caddy?
Yes, freshman in high school. And we decided one Saturday in June or July, I forget, that we were not going to go out that day with the golfers unless we got an increase. And we were getting less than $2 to carry a golf bag for 18 holes, and we all thought that there should be some improvement, and so we stayed outside the golf course on the Saturday morning, and the golf course was set up on the top of a hill in Yonkers, New York, and we'd normally be waiting for the golfers to come and get a ride up the hill with them, but this particular morning we refused the rides, and a couple of hours went by around 10 o'clock in the morning. A committee of the golfers came down and wanted to know what was the gripe. And we told them that we wanted an increase. And they went back up and talked to the other members and other golfers and then came back to us. And we ended up with a 75-cent increase per bag. And that was a real great increase in those days. And that was my first strike.
Did you think if you lost, you never would have become a union organizer?
No, I think we were convinced that their anxiety to get out on the golf course was the right time to go for an increase. And I think it was also a recognition on their part that we deserved an increase.
You're credited with helping to reinvigorate the labor movement. When did you realize that the union movement was declining?
I guess over the period of time, as I moved more into my own position as president of the Service Employees Union and took on new programs and initiated some new strategies in terms of organizing and outreach and working together with other unions who were realizing that it was time for a change. We were a part of the leadership of the labor movement for a number of years, and no one individual or no couple of individuals can be blamed, if that's the proper word, for us not addressing the issues of change. But I think we all came to a realization that we had to reverse the trend of decline in membership, that we had to strengthen the political voice of our members, that we had to improve the perception of the labor movement, both inside the labor movement as well as outside. And that all happened or came to a head, really, over the course of the last 2 years. And I think you're seeing that going on right now.
Some labor leaders have also been great orators who, move large crowds through the power of their ability to speak in public. Many people have pointed out that you're a very low-key personality as a public figure, that, oration is not the greatest gift that you bring to your position as president of the AFL-CIO. I'm wondering if you feel that has ever held you back or if you've done other things to compensate for not being the fiery speaker.
Well, I believe that you you use the talents that you have to the best of your ability, and you also realize that you have to reach out to others who have stronger talents in some areas and complement what you're trying to achieve. And I think we're doing just that. Well, if you look at the three top officers of the AFL-CIO now, we're as different as day and night, and yet we complement each other and are working together with the leadership of the Executive Council of the AFL-CIO with many different talents there as well, and using the strengths that we have where it is important to use different individuals, and recognizing this is not any kind of a limited show. This is about a movement, building a movement that that truly represents every single rank and file worker out there, and I think we're moving in that direction.
Well, I have one last question for you.
Sure.
What do you see ahead in the immediate future for the AFL? What's the most immediate change in tactic that you expect to see?
I think you see a lot of different things, but probably the three most important are our stronger political voice in this campaign and in these elections. But while we're doing that for the short term, we're also building a political network, hopefully for the longer term, that will involve our membership all across the country. At the same time, we're developing a more aggressive organizing program. Our goal is to train 1,000 new organizers over the course of the next year and a half, to put more resources into organizing. The Federation does not do the organizing, the individual unions do, but we can be helpful in bringing coordinated organizing together in terms of the training and assessing of opportunities. And with all of this, reaching out to women and to young workers and to civil rights activists and minorities and religious leaders, we're building a coalition that I think is going to be effective in all of the major areas. And our hope is that we're changing or improving the perception of the labor movement and really relating it more and more directly to rank and file workers all across the country.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you very much.
John Sweeney is the president of the AFL-CIO. His new book is called America Needs a Raise. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
One, two, three, five!
Coming up, the Beatles anthology Video. David Bianculli tells us about the expanded version of the documentary series which was originally shown on TV last fall. And journalist Peter Godwin tells us about growing up white in Zimbabwe when it was known as Rhodesia, as British rule was collapsing. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As a journalist, Peter Godwin has covered extraordinary stories in Africa, famines, wars. As a young man, he lived through an extraordinary story. He grew up white in the final years of white rule in Rhodesia, which has since become Zimbabwe. He's written a new memoir called Mukiwa, A White Boy in Africa. Godwin lived in a predominantly black village where his mother worked in small rural black hospitals and clinics. His parents had moved to Rhodesia from England when Rhodesia was a British colony. As a young man, Godwin was required to join the country's security forces. Rather than serving in the military, he chose to be in the Rhodesian police. At the time, Prime Minister Ian Smith was resisting the transition to black majority rule, which had led to civil war. I asked Peter Godwin what his job was in the police force.
Well, I was rather hoping that my job would be something fairly cushy and non-combative, but in the end, my job was pretty much indistinguishable from that of a soldier. And after some initial service of basically just patrolling around and doing mostly police work, the ordinary kind of rural police work where you're dealing with cattle rustling and theft and rape and that kind of thing, in a tribal area which was called a tribal reserve, which was a rural black populated area mostly. Then the war came to that particular area, and I just got sucked into it, and eventually served with a combat tracker infantry unit, and had a war that really, as I said, was indistinguishable from being part of the army.
When you were in the Rhodesian police force, what kind of assignment made you most uncomfortable?
Well, I wasn't given specific assignments. I was given responsibility for a whole area, really. I mean, the thing that I came into conflict with some other white units who came into the area that I was responsible for and began burning down villages and beating people up because they were on the tracks of a group of guerrillas and they thought that these villagers had information that they were withholding. And I came into direct conflict with these army units, and we had a huge sort of bust up that was about to turn into a massive kind of fight of some sort or other and was narrowly averted. That sort of thing made me absolutely see red and irritated me beyond belief, because quite apart from anything else, it was so stupid. It was absolutely moronic. It clearly wasn't going to do any good to them or anyone else.
There were times, too, I guess this was early on while you served, that you had to do a raid. I mean, you had to do a raid on one chief's home to see if he had subversive literature.
Yes, that made me very uncomfortable as well. The local chief Maduna in my area, who I'd got to know quite well and rather respected, And he was deemed by special branch, by the intelligence officers above me, to be subversive and a danger. So I had to go on raids to his village trying to uncover subversive documents or any evidence that he had contact with guerrillas. And finally, I was on the party that had to arrest him. And I did feel... I felt deeply ashamed of myself, really, for being involved in that. And much later, when I went back to the newly independent Zimbabwe, I did actually go back to his village, and he was by then, you know, well out of prison and a senator and a kind of a very venerated nationalist politician. And I went back to him to sort of try and say sorry, I suppose, in whatever way I could.
Did he remember you?
Yes, not initially. It was so long ago, and I think I'd changed. I mean, he'd met me when I was barely 18 years old. I was in uniform and sort of covered in weapons and one thing another. And it was you know, this was nearly 15 years later, and he didn't recognize me initially, but he did after that, and he was amazingly magnanimous and completely unbitter, and actually just wanted sort of chat about the old days, which was rather a relief.
Did you often have to interrogate people for information?
Yes, I mean, I did have to interrogate people. And normally, if there was a lot of time, it wasn't a problem. There was one particular incident which I've written about in the book, where I was with a patrol. Really, we were following the tracks of a group of guerrillas who had, to my certain knowledge, seven or eight deaths to their responsibility, and we were very close behind them. And one of the techniques that guerrillas who are running away use is that they cover up their tracks, either by getting locals to drive cattle over them, or their various anti-tracking methods that they use. And they went through a particular little village, and the tracks disappeared. My tracker said that cattle had been put over them and everything. And there was one youth in the village, and he just refused to say where they'd gone. And I, because I had just come from discovering the latest murder by this particular group, which was a farmer, I mean, whose brains had been sort of splattered against the wall, I was, I think, in some state of kind of excitement or whatever, and that was the only time really that I think I lost it, and I suppose threatened not to kill him exactly, but to shoot him, and did fire my pistol down, sort of shoot into the ground, and intimidate him into telling us what we wanted, I suppose.
You wrote in your book that the local people were early on helpful and respectful of the police, but then they turned hostile. What was the turning point?
Well, the turning point was partly one incident where a group from a different army unit called the Rhodesian Light Infantry, which was actually an all-white unit, came across from an adjoining area and started beating up people and burning their villages, following a group of guerrillas who'd crossed over. And partly because they were an all-white unit, they really had no idea of the various tribal sensitivities in that area. I mean, the tribe on my side of the hills was a completely different tribe, the tribe on their side of the hills, and didn't even support those guerrillas. So, but I had made an implicit deal, really, with the black civilians in my area, which was that I didn't sort of mistreat them in any way, as long as they told me what was going on, and if they did report the guerrillas in that area, then I would try and keep them safe from retributions from those guerrillas. And it worked fairly well initially, but then it just suddenly collapsed after that happened, and the whole area then just became a sort of free fire zone.
And then local people started saying, hate us and see if we mind. Well, what does that mean?
Well, that was something that it quite affected me. I mean, it was in fact those same villagers who were rebuilding their houses, and I noticed that they daubed that motto on the outside wall of their huts, and I wasn't quite sure what they meant, and I asked one woman. I went up to her, and I've written about it in the book, and sort of said, you know, what does this mean? And it just seemed a kind of a gesture of defiance, whereby they were being... It was almost like a Christian gesture of defiance, where they were saying, you may hate us and you can do whatever you want, but we won't react, we won't do, you know, here we are. And it just struck me as being sort of something that one couldn't really combat, and it sort of took the wind out of my sails a bit. I think I felt sort of utterly shamed by it as well.
Why did you feel shamed by it?
I felt shame because I thought that they had risen above the conflict, that they showed that they could be bigger than what was a kind of petty, racial, pointless little war, and that these people had it in their hearts to be kind of bigger and had a bigger vision in a way than the way we could see things, and that they weren't going to be dragged down into this little spiral of retribution and hatred.
Well, after you finished your period of service in the war, you went to England to go to college and returned about a year later to Rhodesia because your sister, her fiancé, and her fiancé, soon-to-be best man, were all murdered. And they were actually murdered by the army. What happened?
Well, I mean, they were killed and the circumstances of their death are still not entirely clear. There was an inquest and one thing and another, but it returned an open verdict. They were killed in a security force in an army ambush, and it was probably an accident, but nobody really knows what happened. They came round the corner and the army were deploying for an ambush. It was dusk, and they hit the ambush. They ran straight into the ambush and they were all killed. My sister and the best man were killed instantly, and my sister's fiancé was dead on arrival at the hospital where, in fact, my mother worked. And it was one of those incidents that, in a sense, is sort of, I mean, dripping with irony, because they were killed by ostensibly their own side. And I think that just hardened the whole sort of feeling of ambiguity within my family. I think there was sort of a horrible kind of irony about the whole thing. And I certainly didn't want anything to do with the military after that.
Well, you returned for the funeral and to stay with your family for a while, but while you were back in Rhodesia, you were called up by the military again.
Yes, unbeknownst to me, when I'd finished my what they called phase one of my military service, you have to sign a release document, and in the small print of the release document, it says that you still owe them, you know, X number of months service, and that is activated as soon as you return to the country. So I came back to Rhodesia to bury my sister, basically, and got called up and put straight back into the army as a result of this. And there was a furious row about it, and in the end, a kind of compromise, which was that I would have to go back into uniform, but I would be posted just to Harare, to the capital where my parents lived, so that I could go home at night and actually sort of be with them. So that was a sort of rather kind of messy compromise, but we were all furious about it at the time.
My guest is journalist Peter Godwin, author of the new memoir, Mukiwa, A White Boy in Africa. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Peter Godwin. He's written a new memoir called Mukiwa about growing up white in Rhodesia during the final days of white rule. Rhodesia has since become Zimbabwe. He served in the military during the civil war over white rule. Did you ever support the civil war that you were forced to fight in?
No, I didn't. I didn't support. I mean, to some extent, it depends on what one defines as the sort of reason for the war, and I think that's quite difficult, because in any war, even among the people on the same side, they're fighting for lots of different reasons. I can certainly put my hand on my heart and say that I was never fighting to preserve white rule. That was absolutely not my intention and not something that I thought worth fighting for or even realistic to fight for. What I didn't like, what happens is that when I got posted out to Matabele land, the things that I saw there, the methods that were being used by the guerrillas, which were extremely barbaric and savage, the way that people were being, civilians, black civilians were being tortured and killed, I just turned my stomach. And I sort of felt instinctively that I was against anybody who was using those tactics. I just sort of felt it was so uncivilized and so appalling that I could, in all conscience, fight against those particular people. And the war very quickly becomes localized and parochial. You get sucked into the local dynamic of the war on the ground in your little area, which is what happened to me. So that I knew that there were particular guerrillas and guerrilla groups, and I knew their names, some of them, and I knew what they'd done, and I'd seen their rather gruesome handiwork. And in that to that extent, for the most part of my war, I felt I was fighting to protect, oddly enough, the black civilians in my area. And we never supported Ian Smith as a family. I never voted for him once and never would have done, and certainly didn't support the ruling party either. And there were quite a lot of people like me on the white side, people who I don't think were overt racists.
It must have been so hard to explain your actions and your position to people outside of Africa, or imagine even to a lot of people inside Africa.
When I arrived at Cambridge, I got released from the army. I think it was on a Wednesday, and the following Monday I was in lectures in Cambridge, and I had just come out of that the week that I'd left the army. We'd had a whole lot of contacts and various been in combat and one thing another, and a week later I was in Cambridge in law lectures, and I was looking around for my rifle. I was completely out to lunch. I didn't know what had hit me, and I was completely unable really to cope with. I mean, I'd never been out of Africa before. I'd been out once for a week, I think. So I was in some culture shock. I was in shock of coming back to civilian life as well. And I soon realized that over here at that time in the late 70s, Rhodesia was a deeply, deeply unfashionable place. I mean, a white Rhodesian was almost as bad as a white South African, and that in the sort of student milieu, it was a deeply politically incorrect thing to be. And so I just sort of set about not exactly denying it, but just trying to de-Africanize myself. And I did find that I was rather disturbingly very violent. I found that because I'd had exposure to a year of war, I wasn't used to. I mean, these people were sort of very bright students who wanted to sort of have all sorts of conversations and debates about this and that, and I just wasn't really used to that, and would respond to taunting with violence usually. I mean, I just got into a whole succession of fights, and then realized that I really had to just stop it all, and just so after that I just ignored it and just tried to forget that I was from Africa at all.
And did that attitude change eventually?
Yes, but it took a very long time. I mean, what happened was, if you think about it, I came to England to university, and although I'd been born and brought up in Africa, my parents were English. I looked English. I had an English name. I spoke English as my first language, although with a Southern African accent. I tried to dilute that accent, and I didn't draw attention to the fact that I was from Africa, and I never brought it up in conversation. And over the years, subsequently after university, I worked as a journalist for the Sunday Times, and then for the BBC, and slowly, and I was based mostly in London, and slowly I became more and more English, basically. And the funny thing was, just as I got close to being completely de-Africanized, I started to feel homesick and realized that I was just denying a whole massive bit of my own background and my own identity. And it was really for that reason that I sat down to write the book, because I had this sort of burden of a denied past, really, that I just felt I had to come to terms with in some way.
At some point, you were declared an enemy of the state. And I'm not sure, I can't remember whether this is when it was Rhodesia or after it had become Zimbabwe. Why did you become an enemy of the state, and who declared you that?
Well, after Zimbabwe became independent, I went back to Zimbabwe, along with lots of people like me, whites and blacks and Indians and people from all ethnic backgrounds who had originally come from Zimbabwe, because we thought that this was going to be the big multiracial experiment that proved that it could be done, that blacks and whites and everyone else could get on together, and that we would create a multiracial country that would shame South Africa, that would show by example that it could be done. And I worked as a lawyer briefly, and then I was trying to finish a PhD, and then I worked as a lawyer, and then I became a journalist. And what happened in newly independent Zimbabwe, unfortunately, was that the two mutually antagonistic tribes fell out with one another, and there was a sort of pogrom in the south of the country, and a particularly nasty army unit, this time a unit of the new Zimbabwe army, who had been the guerrillas. This particular unit was trained by the North Koreans, and they went into the south of the country and started killing civilians in very great numbers. And I went in as a journalist, basically, and discovered what was going on, and wrote a big sort of three-part series in the Sunday Times, as a result of which I was then declared an enemy of the state and expelled from the country.
So it was the black government who declared you an enemy of the state?
It was the black government of Robert Mugabe who declared me an enemy of the state, yes.
And were you tipped off that you were in trouble?
Yes, I mean, what happened was that they started, after I ran the pieces, they started in Parliament and in the government-controlled newspapers to run big columns and editorials saying that I deserved to be hanged for war crimes, and they were sort of softening up public opinion for something to happen to me. And then and it all started looking particularly sort of dangerous. I mean, I was looking very exposed, and I was warned by colleagues and things that something was probably going to happen to me. And then one day I was in Harare, and somebody came up to me and sort of, you know, knocked on the car door and jumped in and told me to drive around. And the person was a black man who was part of a thing called the CIO, the Central Intelligence Organization, which is a bit like your CIA, I suppose, or sort of cross between the CIA and the FBI. And he warned me that he was in charge of a party that was going to come and arrest me that night, and sort of, you know, begged me to leave the country. And it transpired the reason he was warning me was that his mother was from the tribe that was being whose members were being killed. So he actually approved of what I was doing and didn't want me to be arrested. So I flew out of the country that evening as a sort of a precaution. I still didn't really believe anything would happen, and I thought maybe I was just being scared off. And then indeed that night they did surround my house and sort of, you know, ambush it. But I wasn't there. And I was subsequently declared an enemy of the state and didn't really go back at all for 4 or 5 years.
But how much paradox can one man take?
Indeed.
You must have been so confused for so many years. Well, confused isn't the right word, but I mean, here's a guy who's supposed to arrest you, and he's tipping you off because you're helping to protect his mother's village.
Yes, well, I think confused probably is the right word, and I think in some senses the book was an alternative to therapy, I think, to try and work it all through somehow.
Peter Godwin, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life and your work. Thank you.
Thanks.
Peter Godwin's new memoir is called Mukiwa, A White Boy in Africa. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Tomorrow and Saturday nights, ABC repeats the last two parts of the Beatles anthology, the six-hour TV biography originally televised last November. Also tomorrow, video stores are releasing the expanded 10-hour home video version on VHS and Laserdisc. Beatle fan and TV critic David Bianculli has these thoughts.
I love the Beatles. Always have, always will. Saw them on Ed Sullivan in 64, reviewed the White Album when I was the rock critic for my high school newspaper in 68, and got one of the first copies of Abbey Road right off the record store truck in 69. The Beatles meant everything to me then, and still mean a lot to me now. Even as a middle-aged baby boomer, I'm eagerly swallowing Beatles stuff, from bootleg CDs to the official anthology releases. But when the TV version of the Beatles anthology came out last fall, I couldn't give it a rave review. I loved what I saw, but way too much of the Beatles' music and story was missing. And since it was announced then that an expanded video version of anthology would follow within the year, I said I'd have to reserve final judgment until the full-length Beatles anthology came out. So now it's out. At more than twice the length of the ABC version, once you factor in time wasted on commercials. The 8-tape video is retailing for $150, and the price for the 8 video disc set is retailing for somewhere around $230. That's an awful lot of money, and the TV repeat this week is free. But if you're passionate about the Beatles, save up and dive in. What's on this deluxe Beatles anthology video that wasn't on TV? Lots and lots of stuff. There are more interviews with the surviving Beatles who talk more candidly than they did on ABC about drug use, hassles with police, and even stealing a guitar when they were just starting out. There are hours more of home videos and live performance clips, and a lot more discussion of each Beatle album in particular. And, best of all, there are tons of studio outtakes and mistakes, including many that not only aren't on the anthology music CDs, but aren't on any of my dozens of bootlegs. One outtake segment presents 5 minutes worth of false starts and alternate versions of songs recorded in 1963. Listen to a sample and enjoy.
Take four.
Well, the baby said she's traveling on the one out.
Well, I told
it's
you.
It's you. You
said we'd miss
George.
Out the delay.
One, two, three,
four.
Just to love you, but oh my, this boy, that boy, Joe.
This boy, that boy, that boy.
This boy, that boy.
Take
seven. I should have known better with a girl like you.
Even at 10 hours, this video Beatles anthology isn't what I'd consider complete. Real Love, one of the two new Beatles songs in the ABC and CD versions, isn't included. And neither is any mention of the Paul is Dead rumor from 1969, something I was sure would be covered. But it's terrific and beautifully made, and every hardcore Beatles fan should make plans to either buy or rent it. It brings up an odd question, though, as to which of these various Beatle anthology formats, TV, CD, or video, is the definitive one. It's like the Godfather movies, which have been packaged in so many ways that it's hard to know which is the real thing. The original films, the director's cut videos, or the expanded, chronologically re-edited Godfather saga shown on TV. The truth of the matter is, the medium is not the message anymore. TV, movies, CD, video, what counts is the product, not the delivery system. But that doesn't mean there aren't advantages to the different media. So far as I'm concerned, the Pioneer Videodisc version of the Beatles anthology, with its superb sound and images and its 10-hour length, is as good as it gets.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News and author of Dictionary of Teleliteracy. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Cherry Gross.
I don't know how you were invited. No one alerted you. I learned from the wings at the play you are staging, while my guitar jams.
sitting here doing nothing but aging. Still my guitar gently weeps.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.